Thomas Jefferson School of Population Health supports WHYY. At Jefferson, health is all they do, and public health is a big part of it. Jefferson School of Population Health offers a fully accredited Master of Public Health degree. Classes begin in September, and merit scholarships are available. An information session will be held on Tuesday, May 12th at 5:30 p.m. For details or to register, online at jefferson.edu/publichealthinfo. Thomas Jefferson School of Population Health.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Organizers of the ongoing Philly is Baltimore rally at Dilworth Plaza in Center City expected some 2,000 participants to show up. WHYY's Bobby Allen was on hand and joins me back in the studio. Bobby, what was the turnout today?
Yeah, hundreds were gathered when I left, and many more were pouring in front of City Hall. They had signs with sundry messages. Most prominently were ones that read Black Lives Matter and Justice for Freddie Gray. The organizers called on several Black Philadelphians who, by way of bullhorn, delivered spirited personal stories about tense interactions that they all have been having with police. Some called on participants to become mentors to younger members of their community, and others vented about systemic troubles with law enforcement and the court system that never seemed to be going away.
So overall, to what extent did the event have to do with the protest and violence that recently erupted in Baltimore?
You know, the organizers were drawing a direct correlation there, but, you know, they really hitched the event on two cases. The death of Freddie Gray, the young man who died mysteriously while in police custody in Baltimore, that, of course, set off citywide chaos, as we all know now, and a local case that has some parallels to the Gray case. Brandon Tate Brown, about the same age as Gray, he was pulled over in December, supposedly for driving without headlights on. Police say he was fatally shot as he was reaching in his car for a gun, but Tate Brown's family filed a lawsuit this week saying the cops shot him while he was running away, not when he was reaching for his gun. The suit also accuses the cops of maybe planting the gun in Tate Brown's car to support their telling of events. At any event, though, the demonstrators today are seeking justice in both of those cases. And they think that, you know, they went together today so they could illustrate that these cases point to some larger problems in the criminal justice system. And I caught up with 34-year-old Asa Califf. He came out to the event, and he was actually, it turns out, Brandon Tate Brown's cousin. And here's what he told me.
It's Freddie Gray. It's Brandon Tate Brown. It's a wave now where Black and brown lives mean absolutely nothing. And at some point, you can only oppress people with so much. We are the face of the young generation. We are saying no justice and no peace.
Bobby, were organizers trying to make additional connections between Philadelphia and Baltimore?
Yeah, they did bring up a lot of similarities, and there are many. Both cities are largely Black. Both cities have sizable shares of their population mired in poverty. Both Philly and Baltimore have unemployment rates greater than the national average, and frankly, both cities have notable problems with violent crime. You know, also worth mentioning, they both have Black mayors and Black police commissioners, but face real, seemingly intractable challenges in striking harmony between police officers and some segments of the Black community. So neither city is Ferguson, we're not saying that, but each still has very real strife between minority communities and police officers. Here's another person I spoke to, Julice Gibson. She was holding a sign that said, "Be the change you want to see in the world."
We need to stand together in solidarity. I may not be a Black man, I may not be as targeted as they are, but my father is. My little 7-year-old nephew will be a full-grown Black man one day. I don't want to have to worry about it. I worry about him now, and he's in first grade, so it's all very important to me.
She told me that the rally is just the latest example of frustration that's been building for a while. And the spark that turned her into an activist was the Brandon Tate Brown case.
Thanks, Bobby.
Sure thing.
WHYY's Bobby Allen. And the turmoil in Baltimore is drawing comparisons to the larger riots that happened in April of 1968. Ahead this evening at 6:30, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from Baltimore on what has changed and what has not since then. In other news at Philadelphia City Hall, a councilman has taken the rare step of recalling his billboard legislation. Bobby Heenan says he's doing it in order to implement quick changes now that the state has taken over regulating most billboards in the city.
The uncertainty of what has happened with the state takeover is what I'm trying to remedy. We don't know if there's going to be technical changes necessary. We still need to get with the state and PennDOT as a city, and that hasn't happened yet.
Enan says recalling his bill would make it easier to amend it and get it reapproved. The measure could be back in front of council before they head to summer recess. Just being released at this hour, renderings of what a reworked Love Park could look like. Let's take a peek with Ashley Hahn. She writes for Plan Philly, a project of WHYY and Newsworks.org. Ashley, welcome back.
Thanks, Dave.
So we're taking the wraps off of what is probably going to be very close to a final design. What are some of the highlights?
Well, the biggest highlight of tonight's reveal is that the Flying Saucer building that stands at the corner of 16th and JFK will be renovated.
But it's not taking off and out of this world.
No, but the renovations will give it a new life.
Not a new shape?
No, it'll stay a saucer. The structure has proven viable, so it basically needs to be reskinned. New windows, a green roof, and really peeling back the layers of time that have not been kind to that building.
And green is the overarching color of the entire project.
Indeed. There will be gardens and tree groves and lawn areas that will make Love Park feel much greener and more lush than what we know it as today.
Still a fountain?
Still a fountain. Still a large jet of water from the center of the park, but also a smaller fountain feature that they're referring to kind of colloquially as a bird's nest, a woven set of jets.
When you put it all together, what's the intended use?
The intended use is to be a very public space. It's still meant for all the things we know and love Park for today. Food trucks at lunchtime, holiday gatherings, festivals, concerts, public demonstrations, all those things will remain.
Primarily a pass-through or a destination in and of itself?
We will be able to pass through the park diagonally still, which many people wanted retained. But the saucer building might prove to be a new kind of attraction. It'll have a full-service food and beverage operation in it that'll make the park have different kinds of users stay and maybe into the evening, too.
Affectionately and derisively known as the Saucer, what was its original name and intent?
The Fairmount Park Welcome Center is its current and technical name, but it really is. It was intended to be a welcome pavilion for visitors to the city. It'll still have an informational capacity. What shape that takes, I don't know. But
saucer shape.
Saucer shape, exactly, exactly. But it's still meant to be a welcoming pavilion, and it's a message of the future from our past.
It's a $15 million plan. What's the timeline, and when are we looking at a possible completion date?
So next week, the plan will go before the Art Commission on Wednesday for conceptual approval. The designers will work through the summer to refine their designs. They'll get final approval from the Art Commission in the fall. Construction will begin early next year, and it should open in 2017 if everything goes according to plan.
Thanks, Ashley.
Thanks, Dave.
Ashley Hahn writes for Plan Philly. It's a project of WHYY and Newsworks.org. You can see renderings and read more about the planned Love Park renovations at planphilly.com. In other news this evening, the president of Stockton University hopes to get out of a deal to open a satellite campus at the former Showboat Casino in Atlantic City. Harvey Kesselman told New Jersey's Senate Budget Committee that Stockton doesn't have a clear title to the building because of a legal restriction on its use. Stockton bought the Showboat in December for $18 million, and Kesselman now wants the university to sell it to developer Glenn Straub, who owns the former Revel Casino. Senate Budget Committee Chair Paul Sarlo asked Kesselman if such a sale would be in Stockton's best interests.
I believe so, but not to give up on plans in Atlantic City.
So there would be consideration that he would become the owner of the site, but potentially you would still have a campus at that facility or a different location?
Probably a different location.
Sarlo hopes an agreement is reached soon because Stockton is spending $400,000 each month in state funds to maintain that Showboat building. Partly cloudy, 60 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 6:15. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clouding up this evening, a chance of a stray shower overnight, low 48 degrees. Overcast tomorrow with a 30% chance of rain. Friday's high, 60. To the weekend, Saturday, partly sunny, high 68 degrees. Sunday's the prize, mostly sunny, high in the mid-70s. Still ahead, if you're looking forward to enjoying the spring weather with a long bike ride or a walk, the East Coast Greenway might just be the ticket.
This is Maine to Florida. This is 2,900 miles. So that's what the East Coast Greenway is doing, this massive scale project, this linear park.
NewsWorks Tonight strolls along on WHYY.
University Medical Center of Princeton proudly supports WHYY and is proud to offer minimally invasive robotic surgery with the Da Vinci surgical system, so surgeons are able to perform delicate procedures with enhanced vision, precision, and control, with the goal of providing patients with minimal pain, less scarring, and faster recovery. Learn more about robotic surgery at PrincetonHCS.org or at 1-888-742-7496.
Next time on The Pulse,
hey, oh my perfect. Gosh. That's amazing.
A shiny new toy, the Apple Watch is.
You know, I could actually see my heart rate. It also asks my age, my weight, gender, my activity level.
But where does all that data go?
The technology is racing so far ahead of the law that there's this giant loophole.
The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
The Wilma Theater supports WHYY and presents William Shakespeare's Hamlet. Due to popular demand, Hamlet has been extended through May 2nd. The Wilma is excited to produce what many believe to be the greatest play written by Shakespeare. The fight for the throne of Denmark, quest for moral righteousness, and complexities of vengeance within a 21st century context is re-examined on the Wilma stage, with the powerful actress Zainab Jaw in the title role. For tickets, 215-546-7824 or wilmatheater.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. This week marks 2.5 years since Superstorm Sandy, and to many that seems like a long time ago. Though in New Jersey, just 10% of homeowners awaiting state funding have finished rebuilding their homes. NJ Spotlight's Scott Gurian has been checking in with residents still struggling to recover.
Robin Buck remembers how excited he was when he was first approved for a state grant program to fix his flooded home in Long Branch, New Jersey.
It's like hitting a lottery. I was telling everybody, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, and that's the truth. Like, they were gonna lift my home and they're paying me to do so? Like, that is great.
He spent $43,000 on repairs to make his house livable, then disconnected his utilities, handed over his keys, and moved out last fall, so his state-appointed contractor could raise his home to protect it from future storms.
Probably about the end of November, it started getting a lot colder, and I started shooting out emails and making phone calls about, hey, who's responsible for winterizing my home? And they were like, oh yeah, we're gonna come right out. Have a guy out there Friday, don't worry about nothing. So I never paid no mind to it. I thought everything was taken care of.
But after months of delays, he grew increasingly worried. When he finally went back to check on his house, his worst fears had come true. The pipes had burst, and without electricity to run the sump pump, his basement had filled with several feet of water.
The water line broke behind these appliances here, and it just destroyed the floor. It destroyed my ceiling over top of the kitchen. These are all brand new cabinets. It's destroying my cabinets. So you can notice that the whole house, if you look at the floor line, is going down to this side now.
Buck's contractor, Seneca Smart Jack, no longer works for the state, but state officials say they'll be responsible for the damage. To Buck, it's frustrating that his current problems were not caused by the storm, but by negligence.
It's like, come on, are we working with amateurs? Like, what is going on?
Meanwhile, his family will have to leave their rental unit by the middle of next month, only adding to the pressure. In Union Beach, Andrea Casamatis is facing housing problems of her own. She and her family continue to live in a 37-foot-long trailer while they wait for their home to be rebuilt. Inside, the sink is full of dishes, there are baby toys on the floor, and stuff piled on basically every inch of available space.
It's actually extremely difficult. We have 3 children in here, plus myself and my fiancé, so for the 5 of us, it makes for a very, very tight living quarters.
But her biggest issue is not with her contractor, but with her mortgage. On top of the state Sandy aid she received, she had to take out a loan to finish her new house. Her broker failed to complete the necessary paperwork. She's still waiting for the funds. Standing in the echoey, unfinished shell of her new home, she says it still needs about 45 days worth of work, and it has to be completed by the middle of July.
If we don't have our certificate of occupancy by then the state has the right to take the $150,000 back from us, which we don't have. I mean, we gave it to the builder. It's already in the house. And we're just very frustrated. You know, we're very, just overwhelmed, and we're scared that we're not going to make the deadline.
Down in Seaside Heights, Lambros Flahakis is happy to finally be back in his home. But to get there, he had to exhaust his retirement savings after his insurance company shortchanged him, saying his damage was due to soil erosion rather than flooding. He's one of many considering legal action to recoup more of his losses.
I'm not going to give up. I'm home. I'm not going to go away. I always said from the beginning, I'll go home, I'll fight you from home. And I'm fighting them from home.
Of the more than 8,000 storm victims in New Jersey's largest grant program, only about 900 have completed construction and been able to move back into their homes. The rest remain displaced, struggling to afford their mortgage and taxes on top of paying rent to live somewhere else. Sue Martichek runs the Ocean County Long-Term Recovery Group.
It is just a truly hard burden to overcome. So that's probably why I don't sleep well every night.
2.5 years after Sandy, we've definitely made progress, she says, but we still have a long way to go. For WHYY, I'm Scott Gurian.
Partly to mostly sunny skies, seasonable temperatures this weekend will be just the incentive to get many Philadelphia area residents out of doors. And if Boathouse Row along Kelly Drive in Philadelphia is a destination, you may encounter Spring Summit participants working to expand recreation opportunities in our region and beyond. Let's learn more with Dennis Marcato Soriano, Executive Director of the East Coast Greenway Alliance, and Andy Hamilton, Mid-Atlantic Coordinator of the East Coast Greenway Alliance. Andy, Dennis, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you got perfect weather for this event. Andy, I understand you're going to be presenting at 9:30 tomorrow morning. What are some of the highlights of the Mid-Atlantic Region Report?
Well, some of the highlights are really the amazing things that have been happening here in Philadelphia over the last few years. The East Coast Greenway can't be more indebted to a community than Philadelphia for all the work, the Schuylkill Banks, the Schuylkill Boardwalk, all the work going on toward creating a Delaware River Trail from Spring Garden Street north all the way to Bucks County. It's all coming to fruition by 2020.
And what are the priorities at this juncture?
To complete the Delaware Avenue extension, the Kensington and Tacony Rail Trail, which will connect Larders Point Park, which is a beautiful park right at 73 on the Delaware River. And that will be about 6 miles of trails that will come to fruition in about 2 years.
Dennis, as executive director, help us get the broader picture. What is the range of the Alliance stem to stern?
This is Maine to Florida. This is 2,900 miles, and it's taking people from big cities to small communities to rural areas to explore those communities by bike or by foot at a speed that they can enjoy it and really get to know it. You know, when you're driving 70 miles an hour going through I-95 or something, you get a glimpse of the pines and that sort of thing. But when you're biking and you're walking through Philadelphia, you really get to know that community. So that's what the East Coast Greenway is doing, this massive scale project, this linear park connecting communities from Maine to Florida.
Kind of an urban version of the Appalachian Trail?
That's exactly right. The Appalachian Trail is amazing, and we're so proud that that's part of the national lexicon. What we want is for the East Coast Greenway to join the Appalachian Trail in terms of awareness, because there's 60 million people that live within 25 miles of our route. All of those people could get out and enjoy the East Coast Greenway, whether it's a walk, a run, a bike ride, a wheelchair, stroller, whatever it is, you can get out and enjoy the East Coast Greenway.
I'm envisioning like an erector set, all these different pieces that are over time being linked together. How did it start?
So 23 years ago, there were visionary local Greenway advocates from D.C. to New York to Boston, in Philadelphia, making great things happen in their localities. And they said, let's unite it. Let's bring it together. So at that point, there were only a few greenways that were in existence. And we began to weave those together by the carefully selected, safest roads we could find. So over time, every year we add 50 new miles of greenway. And over time, we've now reached 30% greenway for our 2,900 miles.
Is that 50 miles an average, or it's a targeted goal each year?
It's a targeted goal, and that's been about the average lately.
Dennis, will this ultimately be some 2,900 miles of paved trails?
Yes, indeed. Most of our trails are paved. There are a few that are unpaved, like the DNR Canal towpath right here in this listening area. And it's a beautiful stretch, 35 miles, and we help to keep that surface in good condition after big rains and that sort of thing. There's another section similar to that up in Maine that's 80 miles long that's not paved. But in general, we're going for paved. We want wheelchair accessibility. We want something that cyclists can make some good headway.
Rollerbladers.
Rollerbladers, everybody.
Skateboarders.
Exactly.
Yeah. Inclusive.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Andy Hamilton, Dennis Mercado Soriano, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Andy Hamilton is Mid-Atlantic Coordinator for the East Coast Greenway Alliance. Dennis Mercado Soriano is its Executive Director. The Alliance holds its Spring Summit tomorrow along Philadelphia's Boathouse Row, and you can check out a map of its plans for our region at newsworks.org. Finally this evening, if you don't like what's happening either on or off the field with the Philadelphia Eagles, you can at least take pride in the fans' use of language. Now, that's according to a study from the proofreading website, Grammarly.com. The study claims Eagles fans as a group have the third best grammar in the NFL. Grammarly ranked every team in the league using an algorithm that reviewed readers' comments from the news section of each team website. With a little over 5 errors per 100 words, Eagles fans only lagged behind the Detroit Lions and Green Bay Packers. So, who in the league is in the most need of a grammar lesson? That would be the Washington Redskins fans, who came in dead last with more than 3 times the errors than us Eagles fans. Unfortunately, there's no correlation between fan grammar and winning. The 2015 champion New England Patriots finished 4th to last. We're finished for tonight. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. The Broad Street Run is coming up this weekend. The 10-mile trot takes a lot of volunteer effort, and on tomorrow's show, we'll meet a podiatrist who provides free consults for runners at the finish line. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.